A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is supported by the listener members of the Classical Network. Become a member today at wwfm.org. Thank you. Welcome to A Tempo, the Classical Network spotlight on the arts and culture. I'm Rachel Katz, and I'm your host as we explore the changes at work in the performing arts. Each week, I'll bring you some of the latest news and also take time to examine many of the issues that are challenging arts organizations. We'll look at the impact of the economy, technology, and society on the arts, the importance of arts education, and how these organizations and ensembles are adjusting and innovating as they face the future. As we celebrate the new year, we'll look at what has become a part of many music lovers' New Year's tradition, the Vienna Philharmonic. 2017 marked its 175th anniversary, and the Philharmonic Society celebrated the occasion with the publication of a book looking back on its history. My guest will be author Christoph Wagner-Trankwitz and the book's translator, John Hargraves. I usually devote the first portion of A Tempo to news of the week. This week, however, I think we can all agree that taking a break from the constant news cycle can be a good thing. I look forward to bringing you more headlines and goings-on in 2018, particularly as we await news about the fate of Westminster Choir College. Since our focus today is the history of the Vienna Philharmonic, and in anticipation of its annual New Year's Day concert, I thought I'd present a recording from one of its past concerts. This is from the 1993 New Year's concert conducted by Riccardo Muti, who will be conducting this year in his fifth appearance on the podium of this annual tradition. Here is Muti leading the Vienna Philharmonic in the Radetzky March, the rousing finale to every year's performance. In March of 1842, musicians of the Court Opera of Vienna performed a concert program consisting of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony and Leonore Overture No. 1, as well as some Mozart arias featuring some of the opera's singers. Planned by the Kapellmeister Otto Nicolai, the performance was wholly intended to have a lasting impact, creating an ensemble of highly trained musicians capable of performing the growing body of large symphonic works that would become the mainstay of late classical and romantic orchestral music in the decades to come. Over time, this ensemble, which always continued to draw its musicians from the ranks of the state opera, became the Vienna Philharmonic, which this year has been celebrating its 175th anniversary. 9 months later, New York's musical world would follow suit with the inaugural concert of what was to become the New York Philharmonic, which is also marking its 175th anniversary this year. The Vienna Philharmonic's history is filled with creative brilliance and musical high points, but also tarnished by its acquiescence during World War II, when Jewish members were purged from the Philharmonic and several would die under the Nazi regime. More recently, the orchestra has faced criticism as it appeared to drag its feet in admitting women as full members. This history, the proud and the questionable, are covered in a new book published to mark the anniversary by Christoph Wagner Twankwitz, the opera's chief dramaturg. Titled in English, A Sound Tradition, the book was an initiative of the Vienna Philharmonic Society and features photos of performances, concert programs, and some of the musical personalities who have shaped and defined its sound. Conductors like Gustav Mahler, Richard Strauss, and Wilhelm Furtwängler. It also recounts anecdotes, poignant and amusing alike, discusses some of the elements that have created the Philharmonic sound, and profiles some of its musician members over the years, like the three generations of the Bartholomé family, whose careers with the Philharmonic spanned 120 years. I recently spoke with Wagner Twankwitz about the book and some of the issues it covers, as well as how the Philharmonic, with its deep-rooted traditions, is navigating through today's often turbulent and uncertain musical times. Of course, one of those traditions is the annual New Year's Day concert, which is broadcast on radio stations around the world, and you might recognize his voice as the German narrator during the broadcast. We were joined in our conversation by John Hargraves, who translated the book for its English edition, which was published simultaneously.
There are some very important and also very heavy in any way books about the Vienna Philharmonic, and they wanted to have not really an easy read, but that people understand on only 200 pages, understand how this orchestra was founded, how it developed, how it collaborated with the greatest composers and conductors, and that this book, this is the special thing about it, was published in German and in English contemporaneously. And I'm very happy that the translator, and I'd rather call him the co-author, the English co-author of this book, John Hargraves, is with me today.
It was lots of fun translating it while he was writing it. I was a little worried about whether he would end up changing things, but he was very disciplined about not doing that. So we sort of reached the finish line almost together.
Now, the book starts off with a musical tour of Vienna. Why did you choose that for the opening of this book?
Yeah, this was very important to me. Of course, one could start to say, well, back in 1842, the Vienna Philharmonic. No, I didn't want to do that. I want to have the audience, so to say, the readers, close to me. Let me invite you to do a tour through Vienna, so everybody, every tourist, every visitor of the city can pass by within 10-15 minutes, pass by the most important, the hot spots, so to say, of Philharmonic life, from the Musikverein to State Opera to Haus der Musik, where Otto Nicolai back in 1842 founded this orchestra. So I wanted to begin today because the Vienna Philharmonic is not a historical phenomenon, but a very busy orchestra, and then afterwards lead the people back to this rich and beautiful history.
Well, tell us a little bit about Otto Nicolai, who many may know through some of the works that survive through today. But what was his legacy on the Philharmonic?
Well, he really was the founder. And back in the 1830s, 1840s, it's very surprising that there was no professional orchestra, concert orchestra in Vienna. So he felt the need to perform most of all Beethoven's very for that time very complicated symphonies with a professional orchestra, and he founded it out. He took the members of the court opera. But it was from the beginning a democratic consent. All of the members of the court opera, we want to found a concert orchestra and work as a concert orchestra. And with a lot of discipline and a bit also dictatorial things, Otto Nicolai made it possible that all of the Beethoven symphonies within a few years were performed. And this was really a giant step for musical life in Vienna.
Christoph, was it Nicolai's idea to do the subscriptions, or did that come later?
The subscription concerts, they came later in 1860. And this was, for a long time, also seen as the real founding moment of the orchestra. And these subscription concerts that still do exist, of course, in the Golden Hall of the Musikverein.
Mm-hmm. Well, this unique relationship between the Philharmonic and the opera, which that was something new that I learned. I hadn't realized that deep connection. How has that shaped the Philharmonic and continued through this day?
Yeah, this is I guess this is one of the most important points in the for the special character of this orchestra. They do have a double identity. So these 140 something players are at the same time opera orchestra and concert orchestra. They are employees in Vienna State Opera, and they are free entrepreneurs as a concert orchestra. But this does first mean a lot of work. I think Philharmonic is the busiest orchestra on this planet, with over 400 performances, opera and concert a year. But it also shaped the sound by listening to singers more than listening, accompanying singers, working together with singers, breathing with singers. They orientate their sound, their very sound, on the human voice, which is the ideal sound, more or less. And they collaborated by this with all the important composers of the time, as you name it, Giuseppe Verdi, Richard Wagner. They worked with them in opera and outside the opera. And this double identity, as I call it, is, I think, most important.
And Christoph's making a very important point that they all come from all the players in the Philharmonic start in the opera, and they must spend at least three or four or more years in a certain kind of probationary period before they even can audition for the Philharmonic, and not all of them make it. But it's this excellent first stage in their playing makes for this wonderful glossy sound that they do so well by listening to one another as well as singers. This is great, a great profit for the Philharmonic when they finally get to the Philharmonic.
Yeah, there's also the chamber music tradition, listen to each other, not only accompanying, but through chamber music, so string quartets, but also woodwind octets, any of them, to have this constant this constant practice of listening and adapting to the sound of the others, and this makes them such a unity as well.
Mm. Well, as you're going through the history of the Philharmonic in the first section, you do stop and spend pay a good amount of attention to the Nazi, the Anschluss era. Certainly, there's been criticism in the past until the Philharmonic more recently opened up its history and started taking a closer look. At this point, how much more insight and introspection does the Philharmonic need to do, or, as you said, that moving forward, how does it decide how to move forward versus, as you said, wiping the slate clean?
Yeah, this is a very, very important question, of course, and a very important section of the history. My book is, I think, an easy read with a lot of anecdotes, but in this, the time of the Nazi era, There's nothing to smile about. Well, one must admit that the Vienna Philharmonic confronted their past or those years of the Nazi era very late in the 20th century. They only started in the 1980s, but unfortunately, we have to say that was state of the art in the Republic of Austria. Only with the bit infamous era of Kurt Waldheim, the federal president, people started to realize that Austria was not Hitler's first victim, but there was guilt and there was a lot of collaboration with this horrible regime. And the Philharmonic started decade by decade to expand their historical archive, but it lasted for several years until all the killed orchestra players, the orchestra players that were sent into exile, until they were named and the families also were reconciled as good as possible, and it lasted until December last year that a painting, a French painting that was given to the Philharmonic in 1940, so Raubkunst, robbed art, was given back. Not because the Philharmonic wanted to keep it, but it had to be research had to be done. Whom this painting belongs to? I think in the last 10-20 years, the Philharmonic did a lot of work to research these years and also to
open it up. And they're still opening it up. There's more to be done, but they are this orchestra is such a national institution in Austria. It's become a world institution with their touring and their recording and their wonderful tradition of giving these televised balls at New Year's and during Carnival. So it's a beloved institution. Yeah.
New Year's concert, it's the numbers are really amazing. 50 million people every year are alive with this New Year's concert on 1st of January. 50 million people worldwide, over 90 countries. Are following them. So this makes it the most important classical concert
period
on the planet.
Yeah.
Right. I believe we do air it every year. And I did want to ask, what is it about that concert that has made it possible to become such an international event?
Well, it's popular music of 150 years ago, and it's amazing that the music of Johann Joseph Eduard Strauss have survived the 19th century and into the 21st century. This is a music that is entertaining, but on a high level, but entertaining really for everybody. The waltzes and polkas. And played on this high level by Viennese musicians in a Viennese tradition. Not every waltz, not every conductor, and not every orchestra is really capable of doing these waltzes right. This is a televised worldwide broadcast and televised sensation. And I'm very proud to do it for the Austrian radio. And I think my voice is heard somewhere even in the United States from the stations that take the concert. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is it that you go into quite some detail about the various aspects that create the quote, the Vienna sound? What are the most important components for that?
I guess, as we said, this regular work in opera and accompanying and also adjusting to the ideal of the human voice. This is one important element. Another important element that we have mentioned already is chamber music. So they always control, in smaller ensembles, control their sound, control the precision of sound, if I may say this. There is a long tradition that really dates back to the beginning of the 19th century. There is, for instance, a Viennese violin school going back to Joseph Böhm, who was from Hungary and who was who was educated in France and Italy. So an international mixture of the best in music. But this tradition of a violin school goes back, as I said, 200 years. And
a continuity of teaching, the generational aspect of teaching. When a person joins the orchestra, they learn from the person who's sitting right next to them, and they learn not just how to play the instrument, but how to interpret the works that they become famous for.
Mm.
In that same sense of a tradition, a sound tradition, as the English title goes.
Right, and there are also Viennese instruments that are not played outside of Vienna. The famous French horn. There is a Viennese version of this horn. Played, which is much harder to play, very, very risky. This, how do you call it? Hiccups.
Hiccups, yeah.
Yeah, but the sound is incredibly more soft and smooth of the Viennese horn. The same is true for the Viennese oboe. My brother-in-law is oboist, solo oboist with the
horn,
Vienna Philharmonic.
Is the F horn the one that with no valves? It's a natural horn?
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Very tough to play, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then even Vienna timpani tradition, one of the timpanists of the Gustav Mahler era, Hans Schneller, he invented his own way to build those timpanis. And Gustav Mahler, when he went to New York, he wanted to take Hans Schneller along. He said, no, I want to stay in Vienna. So he took at least a few of the Schneller timpanis to New York to guarantee the sound of the timpani.
Mm.
So these are elements, and also the fact that the Vienna Philharmonic since 1933 don't have a principal conductor, so they are responsible for their own sound. They cannot say Mr. Mehta or Mr. Thielemann or Mr. whoever, Mr. Bernstein told me that it has to be like this. They love to work with the big conductors, and they work with everybody. Mm. But they adapt to the present conductor. But there's no principal conductor who shapes the sound according to his ideas, but the orchestra has its own sound idea, and there's a sound tradition.
Mm, great. One other area where the Philharmonic has come under criticism has been for its lateness, shall we say, in permitting, in appointing women as full-time, full members. They have made progress. And how do you think, where are they now? How much progress is left? And are there still attitudinal issues? For example, there was some discussion that this would, quote, change that Philharmonic sound.
Yeah, there were a lot of worries when women are admitted that the sound might change. Now, this is, of course, ridiculous, and there is a new generation in the Vienna Philharmonic that from the ladies' rooms to a change of the sound, there were invented a lot of problems, and of course, this is all not true. The sound is beautiful as always, although I should say, although there are 12-13% women in the orchestra, but this indeed was a long and painful way. It was not before 1997. That the first woman was admitted, a harp player was admitted to the Vienna Philharmonic. But this changed quickly. It one cannot speed up this process because there are auditions every year, and step by step, women are entering the orchestra. Since 2008, there's has also been a concert mistress, you say, John. No?
Concert mistress.
Albena Danailova. So women in all instruments of the orchestra are coming in. And I don't know. It will be a few more years or decades till there is really equality. So 40-50%. Women, but the door is wide open.
And you mentioned before this probationary period that all players in the Philharmonic must go through of being in the opera first. That adds years to the channel of getting into the Philharmonic. And women must go through that as well.
Well, certainly orchestras, certainly in the U.S. and in other parts and throughout Europe and other parts of the world, are very focused on the future, discovering the future audiences that will maintain them into the future. The Philharmonic has done more outreach with different communities, with students. What are its specific challenges as it looks forward to its next several decades as far as ensuring that future audience?
Yeah, it's an issue for any classical music organization, from chamber music to a giant orchestra like this.
Opera is, of course, this is the same challenge in all the classical musical branches, and the Philharmonics also in the Vienna Philharmonic also in this respect somehow woke up, if I may say so. In 2014 they were awarded or bestowed, what is the word, the Karajan Prize, quite a sum of money, and the members of the Philharmonic really don't need the support for themselves. They reinvested it in international music forums and Be Philharmonic, so that's an initiative to develop and promote and encourage young musicians, but also young audiences. And I think there is also an opening up process of this traditional orchestra on its way.
I think that your audience would like to know that this book is filled with very funny stories about the orchestra and its funny members. Some are funnier than others, and they have a long tradition of joking around and horseplay in their socializing with each other and sometimes on stage. And there are interesting stories about that in the book.
Maybe we could mention, have we mentioned that the book in German is called The Orchestra That Never Sleeps, which seems to us so New Yorkish, the title, but it doesn't work at all in English. So John found the English title a sound tradition, because Vienna Philharmonic is the essence of European music tradition. But on the other hand, it's the busiest orchestra and also directed to the future in a lot of initiatives.
Well, I'll close with that. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. And
we look forward to hearing
you on the New Year's concert.
Yeah, okay.
That was Christoph Wagner-Trenkwitz, chief dramaturg of the Vienna Opera, whose new book on the Vienna Philharmonic is called A Sound Tradition. He was joined by John Hargraves, who provided the translation for the English version. You can find the Philharmonic's website at wienerphilharmoniker.at, and you can hear the live broadcast of the Philharmonic's annual New Year's concert on the Classical Network New Year's Day at 11 a.m. Over the past year, I hope you've enjoyed these conversations that I've brought you, focusing on the changing dynamics and challenges in the arts world. Of course, all of the programs on the Classical Network are possible only through your support of the station. To become a member of the Classical Network, go to wwfm.org and click on Donate. Thank you for being a member of the global listening community that is the Classical Network. And from all of us at the Classical Network, we wish you a happy, healthy, and music-filled 2018. Thank you for listening to A Tempo. I'm your host and producer, Rachel Katz. Join me again next week as we explore more issues and trends in the world of the performing arts. You can listen to past programs of A Tempo by going to our arts and cultural news page at wwfm.org or searching for A Tempo on our program page. A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you.